I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Imagine it's August of 1828 and a diminutive 5'5" silhouette walks out onto a gaslit stage in Vienna. Dressed in black, a white sunken face takes a contorted bow with eyes gazing off into the stillness. For a moment, he looks like a caricature from a political satire, a distortion, an aberration. A glowing, pale white visage appears to make him into a literal specter, a phantom, a chimera, a ghost with its own internal illumination. Then suddenly a violin appears, almost like a magic trick, as an audience's cognitive focus was too busy assessing the aberration in front of them. From there, the most pyrotechnic series of equidistant note flurries transport them to another place. No mortal should be able to play like that, with such speed, articulation, and seeming extemporaneous ability. People came from far and wide to see the man whose name would become nearly synonymous with a skill level seeming only attributable to the consort of the demonic. Today, we make a brief dive into the life and the legend of Niccolò Paganini. This is box number 7. It is perhaps a near cliche that every genre of art, whether it be music or sculpture, architecture or painting, has at some point had to embrace and contend with its own, you know, prodigious phoenixes that seem to ascend above and beyond the normal parameters and concepts of skill. Michelangelo, in his statue, the Pieta, was a stunning testament to, I guess, what is plausibly divine creative heritage, and it still confounds those who grapple with the concept that it was extracted from a singular giant slab of marble. Raphael's grace and color scheme still provide a model for the burgeoning masters, and Leonardo da Vinci's eccentric digressions are being borne out in the manufacturing industry sectors even today. Now, were he alive today, he would be dubbed a sitting fellow at the Smithsonian Institution, patentus holderus maximus. Well, music is in no way less populated with its share of flamboyant, incendiary comets. In general, many names can be tossed into the mix of virtuoso talents, although when presented with such a broad theme, most would stumble over the sheer magnitude of scope when asked for a single name. The age of YouTube has also broadened these avenues by a shocking margin by exposing talents that would have perhaps never been otherwise seen. But by breaking the broader theme of music down into individual components by, I guess, say, instrumental prowess, and then specify an instrumental category, it becomes easier, or at least that's the idea behind this. And yet, sufficient debate could still be, you know, carried on here as the wild cards of opinion and styles, you know, when you say, well, that depends, a jazz guitarist or a classical pianist, you know, you can still, people argue and bicker over those things, but it further demands categorical pairing is the most thing here. And in most cases, that is the rule. But there are exceptions, however few. The violin, which is our subject today, has had many masters that scurried up and down its tiny little neck, and yet One name continually rises to the top as a sort of ultimate plumb line, which with to calibrate and measure one's skill on this most fantastic of instruments, Niccolò Paganini. I don't know if I'm saying his name right. Niccolò, something like that. Anyway, Paganini is known for less for his compositions than he is for his incredible skill on the violin. I guess the goal of my podcast here today is to chronicle both of those to some degree. However, even Paganini's relatively short time in the Romantic period exudes an informational pile than a podcast that is so big that a podcast of this type can never really actually really begin to plummet, not without me wearing myself out into a fetal position of fatigue by trying to research everything about him. So this podcast is presented with the hope that perhaps you learn something new, and maybe I might learn something too, and just something new generally might emerge from all of the required rooting around in the work of other people. Paganini stands as an icon for what I have cleverly called the Dionysian conduit / Mephistophelian marionette school of arpeggiated Führer. I worked hard on that. That's why I couldn't even say it right. The early attributions for his otherworldly skills to that of infernal guidance that may have helped his career at the outset, it may have actually diluted his potent contributions to the instrument. Paganini initially navigated the choppy waters of publicity with all of the deftness of a modern-day publicist, or dare I say, rock star, arriving to a concert in a black carriage drawn by black horses, a sardonic, piercing stare, and a looming, almost skeletal frame, again cast in the hues of black and draped with a cloak of matching color. His physical features were a distortion unto themselves, maintenance notwithstanding. His long features were part of a facet of what modern physicians relegate to a connective tissue disorder that I'll mention later. He routinely played to sold-out venues and amassed a small fortune in performance fees. Of course, none of this hubris would have had near the effect it did were it not for his blindingly adept skill on the violin itself, one that made the most jaded music critics of their day lose their extemporaneous ability to describe or even malign it. Niccolò Paganini was born in Genoa, the illegitimate son of Antonio Paganini and Teresa Bosciardo. His father was a dock worker as well as a shipping clerk. These vocations paled in comparison to his almost obsessive devotion to music, out of which, by the way, he drove his son nearly mad with his relentless demands for perfection and practice. And though he was known as quote-unquote amateur, a phrase normally reserved to those who endeavor for something out of love, his son, Niccolò, preferred to elaborate on the aspersion to mean, quote, not without talent. Paganini's mother was different, though, and a lot less dictatorial. Her nurturing temperament was perhaps the balancing factor against his father's fanatical handlings and provided the needed atmosphere for both he and his brother Carlo to receive the early mandolin and violin lessons. She claimed to have an angelic intermediary visit in which she was told, quote, there would be a great career for little Niccolò, and acted on this to the best of her ability. Paganini's relationship with his mother would remain unbridled and tender even after his later success at breaking his father's dictatorial reins over his music. Paganini was a walking medical profile. Although one biographical account merely refers to him as, quote, a sickly child and an even more sickly adult, further elaborations draw a distinct connection between Paganini's onstage affect and the maladies that plagued him his entire life. We can note the words of one critical publication today, the Leipziger Musikalische Zeitung. Look, If you speak German and you're listening to me, you've got to forgive me at the outset. But anyway, here's what that paper said. Quote, "This man with his long black hair and pale face opens to us through sound, a world that we may have experienced before, but only in dreams. There is something so demonic in his appearance that at one moment we seek the, quote, hidden cloven hoof, and at the next, the wings of an angel." Well, the previous fall, Paganini had all his teeth removed in a painful surgical extraction, and perhaps the sunken nature of his mouth contributed heavily to this image. Further first-person accounts consistently describe a tall, thin frame, long arms, spider-esque fingers, remarkably pliable and limber joints, as well as translucent skin, otherwise known as Keith Richards. Okay, no, that's not true. Some modern physicians have retroactively diagnosed Paganini as a prime candidate for Marfan syndrome, which bears every single one of these characteristics amongst others. Not a direct medical diagnosis, but nonetheless, that's the best guess, based upon the fact there's not a lot of photographic evidence other than one. As Margaret Campbell states in her book, The Great Violinist, Paganini was, quote, "the quintessence of eccentric genius," unquote. Of course, this description encapsulates the previously stated issues with his appearance, but coincides with a rude temperament, abrupt manner, brusque in his financial affairs, with an eye always peeled for the pretty lady. Now, this is enough to sink many a career at the outset, but these characteristics, when married to a tenacious ascendant will and stupefying violin chops, would carry him on a 40-plus year career in music before he would ultimately succumb. It should go without saying that Paganini's vibe would also be the ground zero influence for many a guitarist who would also generate certain Mephistophelian suspicions. In fact, as this podcast progresses, we will examine the life of a few of these folks in what I will satirically refer to as Mephisto's Minions. In the Mephisto's Minions subsection, we will make conjectural claims, anecdotal leaps, and flagrant conspiratorial inferences to the chosen target of implied satanic reference. Is this person's talent the result of unexplored musical ability? Or is it their ability to negotiate the intricate diatonic tunnels of musical modalism fueled by consorting with Captain Howdy through a Ouija board, chatting up the Witch of Endor, or signing a contract with Beelzebub at a 20th century dirt intersection somewhere in Mississippi? Is Apollyon the wind beneath their wings? Is Leviathan the lather in their hair? Is Belial the god of bass riffs? Or did the pentatonic scale come from some clandestine log-rolling session with the Anunnaki? Or even worse, are the Osmonds descendants from the Watchers on Mount Hermon? We will explore each one every time we digress into
Mephisto's Minions.
I know. It's sad. It's a sad digression. But nonetheless, I'm going to target practice for a few minutes. And the first target of intrigue is Swedish guitar firebrand, brash personality, and exceptional rock hybrid of the violin and electric guitar, Mr. Yngwie J. Malmsteen, who hails from Sweden. And to quote David St. Hubbins from the band Spinal Tap, it's a good thing he put the J in there to keep from being confused with all the other Yngwie Malmsteens out there. If you can't see this in print, look on the front of my podcast. His first name is spelled Yngwie. And before I ever heard it spoken, I thought it was pronounced Yngwie. Anyway, Yngwie came on the scene in the 1980s and literally created a new inflection point not seen since Eddie Van Halen revolutionized the guitar back in 1978. No one understood how it was possible to play a guitar like that, especially with the techniques called permutation, technique that involved playing a portion of a scale and then returning to the second note from that scale and playing through it again at a high rate of speed and adding the next highest note and continuing to stair step like this until you reach the intended completed note or the resolution. I don't know if I've got an example. Okay, I admit, a rather jarring example, but I also can't, you can't use more than, you can barely use anything on here. So just wanted to give you that little clip right there. But, guitar players like myself, completely dumbfounded by techniques with articulation like that. Then he started citing Bach and Paganini as his primary influences and went crazy trying to research them. We all did, and Bach was easy, though, because we'd all heard about him, but Paganini was a little more obscure, and we didn't have the internet at the time, and so ultimately, I ordered a cassette tape of Itzhak Perlman, renowned and possibly considered the greatest living violinist, and ironically, the brother, the sibling of Rhea Perlman, the wife of Danny DeVito, and played that notorious part on the series Cheers. But anyway, so I went and thought, I'm going to order these violin tapes and I'm going to become a person who can distill the finer elements of the violin and Paganini's articulation into my own guitar playing. And as soon as I put that cassette tape in, I was in a fetal position of despair. And I realized I'd never ever be able to interface this to my guitar like Mr. Yngwie Malmsteen. So I did what naturally all good people with a good heart do. I immediately attributed his skill to the devil, which is sometimes what happens when jealous, non-playing characters like myself manage to be outshined by other people. I'm notoriously bitter competitor, and I prefer to kneecap my opponents with slanderous metaphysical aspersions. Well, I dropped the whole subject for 35 years until researching this podcast, and then I decided, since I actually witnessed Mr. Malmsteen's skill myself about 7 years ago, that I better write the people who allegedly have the upper hand on the subject, the Vatican, via Washington, D.C. I say this because when you look in all the iconography, movies, television, and stuff, whenever ever somebody has to grapple with, old Lucifer himself, it's always people that are dispatched from the Vatican. They don't have a great winning record, though. Matter of fact, they're sort of like the Cleveland Browns for demonic exorcisms. But nonetheless, I'm going to write them. And so I write, Dear Vatican, I was recently reading the Exorcism of Annalise Michel by Felicitas Goodman when something occurred to me. It's been percolating with me for a while now. Back in 2017, I went to see prodigious rock guitarist and neoclassical firebrand Yngwie J. Malmsteen in concert in Vallejo. During this concert, I witnessed what I believe to be a literal transmogrification of Mr. Malmsteen into the perfect replication of the Niccolo Paganini daguerreotype from 1840. Malmsteen immediately transformed from a corpulent, fat-fingered demigod of the guitar into a gaunt, I am a piece of work, darkly dressed, ash-ridden skeleton with the telltale signs of Marfan syndrome. And because Paganini was reputed to have consorted with the adversary for his skill, and because of his less than stellar relationship to the church, I figured it was worth mentioning. My friend told me not to bother with this at all, but after reading about what happened to a young Bavarian girl in 1976, I figured anything was possible. At first, I thought I was just seeing things, but when he broke his small E string doing a cover of Paganini's Caprice No. 24 and was seemingly able to detach the tendon between his fingers to play a trill between the 1st and 22nd fret, I just assumed something bad was afoot. Any insight you could provide would be helpful. Sincerely, me. So, God. Anyway, back to Paganini. I can't let this Swedish guy hijack my thread. I got to keep it feng shui. Feng shui. Feng shui, is it? Feng shui? All right. I got a barking dog in the background. Paganini's lessons started at home in Genoa, but they wouldn't continue for long. He managed to fatigue two masters, Cerveto and Costa, both from Genoa, before moving on. The latter presented an 11-year-old Paganini to play a church mass on May 26th of 1794. The young Niccolo played at church and aroused mutual admiration, according to one observer. This would not be the last time young Paganini would astound people. In fact, far from it. Word of the child prodigy spread like wildfire. His father took him to Parma to study with violin master Alexander Rolla. And in his historical compilation, The Great Masters of the Violin, Boris Swartz chronicles a particularly poignant incident in the life of the young violinist. Quote, "When father and son Paganini arrived in Parma, they found Maestro Rolla ill in bed. While waiting, Niccolo noticed a manuscript of Rolla's latest violin concerto. Casually, the boy picked up a violin and sight-read the music with such perfection that Rolla, rushing out of bed, exclaimed, 'I can teach you nothing. In God's name, go and see Peer. Here, you're wasting your time.'" Unquote. Reminds you of Mozart, excuse me. Somewhere among the considerable chronological fog, though, Paganini composed what are his most infamous and notable 24 caprices for solo unaccompanied violin. Now, these 24 endeavors not only completely took the technical approach to the instrument into stratospheric territory, but remained daunting and even a nauseating hill to climb for the aspirant even today. Note the prelude to caprice number 5. Perhaps even an unintentional visual harbinger of the precipitous obstacles this teenager would throw onto the path behind him. That is, if you were able to stare at the actual sheet music of a phrase like this. Now, the last phrase of that section, if you were to stare at it, it looks deceptively musical, but in reality is nothing but a sliding glissando chromatic run in the key of A. Now, this kind of phrasing may explain some of the disparaging treatment the caprices have endured at the hands of modern masters, and as Sachs would note in his book called Virtuoso, it is undeniable that they are hard to stomach when played unexceptionally. Ignaz Moscheles, one of the most celebrated contemporary pianists of Paganini's day, wrote the following post-concert review. "Had that long, drawn, soul-searching tone lost for a second its balance, it would have lapsed into a discordant cat's meow, but it never did so. His compositions were so ultra-original, so completely in harmony with the weird and strange figure of the man that if wanting in depth and earnestness, the deficiency never betrayed itself during the author's dazzling display of power." Now, the caprices were not conjured out of an inspirational vacuum, however. Paganini had himself discovered Locatelli's already 50-year-old work, Le Arte del Violino, which contained a set of caprices also, and also numbering 24 of them. The one you just heard, by the way, from Paganini was Caprice number 5, intro. Locatelli's work was already prone to obscurity when Paganini wrote his own, but he paid tribute to the master by actually quoting Caprice number 7 in his own Caprice number 1. I'm not going to demonstrate that here, but it's worth looking into. It would not be until his 19th year that young Paganini would extricate himself from his father's oppressive, even obsessive tutelage. He moved to Lucca, where he would spend the next 8 or so years amassing a nice income, conducting the new national orchestra in northern Italy, and then gambling it away outright. Did I mention Keith Richards? So severe were his gambling vices that he even pawned his violin at one point, only to arrive at a concert without one. Paging Keith Richards! Lucha was transformed literally overnight when Napoleon's sister, Princess Elise, was appointed as a sovereign ruler. Paganini's virtuosity did not remain concealed long, and he was soon commissioned as a solo violinist for her court. This is not to imply that he garnered any personal aggrandizement from this position. In fact, he reminisced by saying, "I had to conduct the opera whenever the reigning family attended and play three times a week at court and give a big concert every fortnight at the formal soirees, but Princess Elise did not always attend or else did not remain all through the concert because my harmonics irritated her nerves." This is literally the equivalent of a rock guitarist deliberately causing feedback, trying to drive people out of the room. This, nothing changes. As it says in the book of Job, there is nothing new under the sun. During this period of time, Paganini developed a penchant for performing entire pieces on the G string by itself, but development of this technique remains somewhat clouded in apocryphal stories. There are legends that say Paganini's single-string prowess was acquired while doing time in prison for killing a mistress. But Paganini was, quote, probably frequently ill during those years and could not play publicly. It's possible that he fabricated a prison story just to simply ameliorate for the perceived weakness of just being sickly and unable to be this magical 18th century rock star. But Paganini practically monopolized the Italian urban legend mill single-handedly and even transcending art itself. And while there's no direct proof of his incarceration, he seemed to make very calculated statements of ambiguity that kept inertia intact, along with a little help from contemporary artists and painters. There's a few famous ones. Louis Candida Bullinger painted Paganini in prison, which shows him sitting in a cell with one window practicing his violin. So I'd leave that up to history itself. Paganini left Italy in 1828 at the age of 44 and headed to Vienna, where he would perform 20 dazzling concerts, one eclipsing the next until his popularity reached a fever pitch. He then headed to Berlin, followed by Paris, and eventually London. And throughout these performances, the first-person accounts asserted that Paganini's hands were merely guided by an invisible devil standing next to him. Paganini appropriated the rumors to his benefit and even allegedly added to his already pale complexion by patting his face down with ash prior to a performance. Oddly enough, Paganini embraced two legions of theoretical devils. One were the existent theatrical devils that helped fuel an already pyrotechnic musician into the pantheon of fame, typical rock star stuff, and the second were the devils of vice that took his life into a personal and professional hell. Various business ventures, to include a casino, as well as volatile romantic involvements and marriages, ran commensurate with the ebbs and flows of Paganini's income. His health took one final blow with an advancement of tuberculosis, this stemming from a constant ingestion of mercury as the apparent cure for syphilis. I will let general speculation decide where that came from. Paganini died in Nice. I think that's how you say it. Nice? Is it Nice? Nice? At the age, some researcher you are, Ron, at the age of 57. Though a Catholic from birth, his refusal of the extreme unction in the mind of the church was a tacit confirmation of his satanic involvements, and his body was conferred to a basement for 5 years. It was held in state, literally hostage, until finally his family's petitions were answered in, I guess what you would call a Pyrrhic victory. And in 1845, he was finally laid to rest at Parma. All in all, Paganini died as he had lived, passionately, with great notoriety, and never without controversy. Now, all of Paganini's works were essentially showpieces, but that does not mean he was by any stretch a weak composer. He wrote for the guitar, believe it or not, as well as the violin, but his notable works are, not surprisingly, geared for the violin. And while the caprices certainly fit this mold, Also fitting this mold is his infamous Moto Perpetuo Opus 11, a milestone for every serious violinist and, might I add, guitarist now, and a painfully arduous metronomic exercise in its own right, pure 16th notes without a single pause and all logically laid over a simple piano accompaniment, thus. Anyway, you get the idea. I have to cut that off before I wind up with some copyright flag or something. I have no idea how all this works, but just trying to use bits and pieces. So anyhow, and while The Flight of the Bumblebee by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov is faster by all technical standards, it's almost jarring in its tension and presents more of a technical show-off launching pad than anything the ears care to hear. Guitarist Nuno Bettencourt of the band Extreme makes great use of it in his live shows, however, and at least version of it, an offshoot of it, and it cannot be performed sloppily or you will be laughed completely off the dais. In 1829, the German violinist Gurr managed to compartmentalize Paganini's unique brand of playing composition into a few categories. One, scordatura, bowing, left-hand pizzicato, harmonics, and playing exclusively on the G string, and the last one, finger technique. Scordatura was mistuning, and it was part of a staple of Paganini's playing, and makes no mystery of the fact that he wanted his violin dynamics to be optimum. And by tuning the entire violin up by a semitone, he was then able to play in a flat key with a preponderance of open strings. Maybe that's musician talk here, but if you do play anything, you will understand that. The other method employed by Paganini was his tendency to alter one string only. Usually he would pull the G string up to B flat, so he could fulminate in the key of C minor with impunity over an orchestra set to E flat minor. Paganini's Violin Concerto No. 1 was typically played by him using this technique, and although today it is widely approached in standard tuning, the alternative being far too arduous an adjustment for most players even today. Paganini composed with a bowing technique known as the ricochet, a series of notes that are produced by the bow's tendency to bounce across the strings and produced a rapid-fire set of 32nd or even 64th notes. If you don't know what a 64th note is, it's basically the speed of light. Caprice No. 1 begins abruptly with this technique, and while impressive to the ear, is far more pleasant with its calculated use in Violin Concerto No. 1 in D major. Allegedly, Gurr witnessed Paganini peel out Moto Perpetuo, the entire passages with this bowing approach, although today it is performed with a staccato technique. And as Schwartz observes, there is not a living violinist capable of playing the piece as described by Gurr. Paganini's left-hand pizzicato allowed for quick interchange between bowing and itself and most likely emerged as a result of his experiences on the guitar. This technique allowed for a muted descending arpeggio to be played by pulling the fingers off the string in a sideways motion. And today, this is a standard technique among guitar players known as a pull-off. Pull-offs and hammer-ons contribute to what we call the legato technique. Now, harmonics, though existent in the 18th century, were a favorite stunner employed by Paganini insofar as he would use more than one at a time. He wrote entire passages for harmonics, many of which are skipped completely today, as they are a risky endeavor at best and will sound like a cacophonous honk or a cow stuck in a gopher hole if you even try to play them. It is interesting to note that the 24 caprices contain no harmonics. In fact, that shows how seriously he may have approached his first official work, even though he wrote those in his youth. And of course, Paganini's most notorious skill was his ability to finish a concerto on a single string, and this feat alone is noteworthy, but dependency on a single string would betray a player's enormous and almost abnormal ability to traverse the neck without shifting positions. His personal physician, Dr. Bonatti, wrote in 1831, "Paganini's hand is not larger than normal, But because all its parts are so stretchable, it can double its reach. This is possibly, by the way, the Marfan syndrome they were talking about. Back to this. For example, without changing the position of the hand, he is able to bend the first joints of the left fingers, which touch the string, sideways at a right angle to the natural motion of the joint, and he can do it with effortless ease, assurance, and speed. Essentially, Paganini's art is based on physical endowment, increased and developed by ceaseless practicing. Now, even though Paganini literally revolutionized the approach to the instrument within the framework of his own compositions, the structural choices with regard to his writing almost never transcended the rules of the day as they did with Beethoven. His existent works are recorded in one form or another, with the majority confined to his primary influential works. Perhaps this, again, stems from the guitar's inability to shine its way out of the incredible shadow cast by Paganini's violin exploits. He also wrote pieces geared for the violin and other instruments, but they are comparatively few and negligible. So, Niccolo Paganini made a huge meteoric splash on his craft, and a splash big enough to reverberate through the hands and the minds of those who grapple with his work even in the 21st century. His pieces have been appropriated in full or in part by guitar players who realized their flat-picking ability could be greatly augmented by merely venturing his work in piecemeal fashion. He has been invoked in motion pictures. Most notably would be in the movie Crossroads, where Steve Vai managed to recreate part of Caprice No. 5 in Ralph Macchio's duel with Jack Butler, the Devil's guitar player. Oddly enough, here we are with cutting heads against the Devil's minion, and also elucidated in The Devil Went Down to Georgia by the Charlie Daniels Band, another good guy versus devil musical loggerheads head cutting session. He's been invoked in motion pictures, television soundtracks, and even recently recorded by world-renowned banjo maven Bela Fleck of Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, who managed to take his banjo and produce an enormously nice-sounding, euphonious bluegrass version of Moto Perpetuo No. 11. But really, what's the point of my podcast? It is to do nothing more than my intent to evaluate Paganini's satanic influence rating on a scale from 1 to 5. Reasons. One, perpetuated rumors about his consort with the devil. Technically counterintuitive to me because there's no need to brag if it really happened. But he does get style points for melodramatic entrances. His otherworldly skill. Now, this is a common tendency, if not outright jealousy, to attribute to the infernal what is actually born of the incessant. Paganini's relentless practice regimens were well known and documented by everyone, including his physician. But those attributions are boring, so why not attribute them to something else? Although number three, his refusal of the extreme unction, which I guess is like the last rites, but it's the pre-death version. The fact that he was raised a Catholic, Paganini was in dire straits physically and dying of tuberculosis. And while standing at the edge of the abyss, he waved off any last-minute attempted amelioration for his soul. So his lack of concern for his own eternal disposition at least gives me a little bit of pause there. So on a scale of 1 to 5, I give him 1 fallen star. Oh, maybe 2, since he overcharged his patrons on levels that, if you factor in modern inflationary models, rivals front row seats at a Taylor Swift concert. In fact, so much were the complaints about his high ticket prices that the English responded with poetry. Who are these to pay 5 guineas to hear this tune of Paganini's? Echo answers, pack of ninnies. See, even we think we're more clever than these people. They just created a meme. This is a meme. Meme culture in the 18th century. All right, 2 fallen stars. Just wait till I get to Jimmy Page. Anyway, perhaps someday the force of his name will catch up with the inertia of his legend. Or perhaps some unknown works are yet waiting to be discovered in some nondescript Genoan attic to revolutionize yet again the conventions of the violin. an event that is the fodder of dreams and the stuff that exemplifies the name that carries an implied whirlwind of mystery and fury, Niccolò Paganini. And until next time, this is Box Number 7.